Yes, you heard that music and you've been hearing it now. Today is day four of that wonderful music. It's been adopted this week as a recurring theme as we discuss the major case everybody is tuned into, the trial of Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis. Facing charges in the death, in the killing, I should be more accurate, of George Floyd. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. We return to the same theme of what is going on in this trial. And we'll take a short pivot off of it today as we introduce something else related, very much related to the case, but I'm going to ask you to think about it and tell me whether it has occurred to you, and that is the intersection of race and class in the trial of Derek Chauvin. You know, I keep stumbling on his name. When I first saw it, it sounded to me like a French name, so I said, if you remember, I called him Derek Chauvin, V-I-N, is Vin, but I've heard Chauvin. I wish I knew how to pronounce his name, but it's just going to be that way. You know who it is I'm referring to. So we want to take a look today as we keep pace with this case in Minneapolis, with the intersection of race and class, the manifestations of race and class, and how those manifestations are likely to give us a hint as to the impact or effect, not only in the outcome of the trial, but on society itself. What is it that we are observing here? It kind of was weird as I looked at the testimony of a couple of the witnesses who were African American, by the way, the ones that I saw. And that's when it came to me. It's a very strange kind of twilight zone, it seems, that we're walking in. It's as if we're outside looking in, but then one of the witnesses just broke down on the stand and brought the whole thing right back to reality, because he didn't see himself differently from George Floyd. And suddenly he was right back in reality. When he first started out with his testimony, he was narrating as if he was a little bit removed. He was narrating the scene that he had experienced. And then all of a sudden, he switched and broke down in tears. And I don't even know if he was aware of that, but it hit me right away. He was no longer, giving a commentary of a separate incident that was outside of him. He was talking about him. He saw himself in George Floyd. And he was physically jarred back into the present. It was a phenomenal moment for me, observing it. But I think most people missed it. At the moment that he understood, he wasn't just testifying in a case. He was, and still could be, the subject of a similar case or circumstance. And I said, well, this would be a good topic to discuss, because he was literally having a kind of out-of-body experience as the relator of the event that he had experienced. And his feelings toward Derek Chauvin. And then it came down on him, and he just broke down. And I understood it differently from the literal thing that was happening. He was a witness, after all, testifying in this high-profile case, and he was behaving like a witness. And suddenly, he was situated in the middle of it, but not just as himself, but as not only George Floyd, but as all Black people. It was, for me, a startling moment. And I wished somebody had seen it. It was that jarring. And it happened unexpectedly. It happened almost as, in the course of testifying, nothing unusual outside of what you would expect in a court of law. He's not the first person to cry at this trial, but his was a special cry. And it brought me directly to the matter of the intersection between race and class. And for him too. Although he didn't say it that way, but you can tell he felt it. He felt it. And in a way, this case is having that kind of impact in our nation. Many whites are jarred, many Blacks are jarred for different reasons, from different perspectives. But it is inescapable that there is an allegory being told here. It is not just one-dimensional, the case against Derek Chauvin for dispatching a Black man from this world in the most undignified and brutal way. It reminds us, all of us, I hope, it reminds us that this country still has not done its business in correcting or ameliorating, at least to some significant degree, the intersection of race and class in America and what it has wrought. The the evil is still with us. And in this trial, it's kind of clinical. It has to do with evidence. It has to do with determining whether this was a murder, whether George Floyd died of other causes. It's very clinical. They're talking shop. But when I saw this man's testimony, testifying, and you can see him grapple all at once, it kind of came out of nowhere. He said, yes, yes. In our lives, in these days, in these times, as people of color, we do our best, I think, to tamp down these feelings, not look at the reality of our existence. I spoke just 2 days ago about systems theory. And I returned to it in my own way last night as I was cogitating about this. And it is really, really imperative that we understand the importance of systems. How we are enmeshed in them, whether we want to be or not, and the absolute need for the creation of systems that help us out of this dismal situation that we find ourselves in. It didn't feel good to watch a man, of course, for the lawyers, this is good stuff. Here is a man in his 60s crying on the stand. And all I could think of was he was not crying about the case. He was crying for all Black people. In his testimony, he came to recognize that George Floyd was him and me and everybody else out here. The difference is systems have been organized to lift some Americans out of the morass and to make sure that the rest remain there. So let us look at this. It's a theoretical question today. It's a kind of abstract question, but it really isn't all that abstract. It is a question we have been dodging, and we dodge it every day. This intersection of race and class, with both forces bearing down on us in different ways every day. So, did you spot the intersection of race and class in the course of this trial so far? And what did it raise in your consciousness? How did you deal with it? And how are you dealing with it? Race and class coming together in a murderous event. There's still the insistence that of casting doubt. Was this a murder, or was this the end result of self-inflicted negligence? And so we are gradually being pushed to consider that what we saw, we didn't see. What we feel in our gut is misplaced. And we have to be open-minded now. We have to stretch this a little bit to accommodate things that we generally do not consider. That's the indirect plea. What do you say? At 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Well, we start off with Jeremiah from Harlem. You're on the air.
How are you today, Yatrice?
I'm hanging in. How about you?
Same here. Hanging in there. We're hanging in there. Let's sustain ourselves as well as we can here. Now, I want to say, first of all, when these instances occur before the general public, and I don't know exactly when this started, I suppose it started in my recollection with Rodney King, but perhaps someone a little older than I am might point to a previous hallmark, negative hallmark in this ongoing violence against Black people, people of color at the hands of police. And what I'm trying to say is, when you see a horrific act, a murderous act, a criminal act being carried out and it's captured on video, how have we gotten into this weird shift where we're debating whether we've seen what we've seen or not, instead of simply engaging in the discussion of how do we punish the person who did what we all just saw? But they instead have created the weird thing of don't trust your lying eyes. Did we see what we see?
That's this right. Unbelievable. Do you believe me or your lying eyes?
Right. There's that. Now, let me also say something somewhat radical, and I'll say this in any variety of conversations that I've come in over the past several years when I came to the realization within my own mind, which is that as a Black person, as an American African, a person of African descent, et cetera, whatever you want to call me. And frankly, I'm a person with heritage from all around the world. I literally have blood from every continent in the world, except for Antarctica, of course, and Australia. I have Native American blood. I have Asian blood. Actually, a friend of mine said that I'm promoting racial harmony unto myself. But despite my diverse background, I am Black. I'm a Black man within that paradigm. And as a Black man, I do not consider myself a citizen of America. And why would you say that? Because I've seen one, or why would I say that? Because I've seen one instance after another of Black people being murdered, unarmed Black people in many, many cases, being murdered with total impunity. And the people who murdered these innocent people didn't go to jail. In many cases, didn't even get indicted, didn't even lose their jobs. And if we followed the case, they actually went on to get raises and promotions and succeed within that power structure, despite these horrendous things that they've done. So my point is, if you can murder me and get away with it, then I'm not a citizen. Who am I kidding? Who am I kidding? I can engage in some of the modalities of citizenship, like a symbolic vote, which I hope gets counted somewhere. I can go and be a consumer. I can go and spend money. I can have tax dollars extracted out of my income. But I'm not a citizen. If you can murder me in my own home, like in the case of Breonna Taylor, and there's no repercussions about it, there's no backlash, et cetera, et cetera. So that's my point, is that people of African descent, unfortunately, we're not citizens in America. Maybe that will change one day, but let's not kid ourselves.
Well, you addressed the race issue. How about the class issue? Does it matter to you in this scenario that we're experiencing collectively now?
Well, class is always there. Let's be real. You know, if you don't have money, you can get crushed like a cockroach. if you do have money, you have some recourse to defend yourself. And, you know, and frankly, let's be honest, Eutrice, now that you mention it, do we really respect people equally? Like, that's what I would really love to see in this world, is people who claim to respect all human beings really start to practice that. But we don't. We help in aggrandizing the Joe Bidens of the world, the what Guy Debord, author of Society of the Spectacle, called the stars of consumption and the stars of decision. We sit here and we aggrandize these people and we help them perpetuate the image and the mythology that they're more than human. And they're certainly not. And it's really sad to me that, you know, we value European imagery more than just the image of a human being. So, for example, you know, if you put someone in a bourgeois European suit and you say, oh, that's a respectable person. They must be intelligent. They must be educated. Well, you know what? What if there's a brother or a sister naked in the middle of the forest wearing a loincloth? That person might actually have a lot more to tell you about what life actually consists of. But we have this image of the person with the suit on. And at the same time, we've forgotten about a really important concept we shouldn't lose track of, which is the concept of the educated fool. And we're so enamored by letters and titles. And you know what? Some people are just wrong, despite their education and despite their learned attributes. People are often just wrong about things. Even
thank
educated
you so
people.
Much for contributing today.
Thank you.
Very thoughtful presentation. Thank you so much. Tony from Orlando, you're on the air.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling in.
It's amazing you brought up this topic today, because that's exactly what was running through my mind yesterday. I was driving home, listening to the case over the radio. They kept replaying the incident in different angles from the police cams, and
yes.
The whole crime scene just kept being recorded in my mind. And one thing that stuck out was, like I said, I was listening to it on the radio, so I'm not sure who exactly was saying it, but there was a gentleman on the side that kept saying, "You can't win. You can't win." And
yes.
George Floyd kept saying, "I'm not trying to win. I don't want to win." And that told me, that was the system right there. He was saying, basically, you can't win against the system. You have to accept them to treat you like dirt and accept the consequences, because that's what they were treating him was like dirt, because they didn't even explain to George Floyd why was he being confronted by the police until he was already being apprehended. And I think they made a slight comment about fraud, and then George Floyd acted in confusion, like, what do you mean fraud? I don't think George Floyd even knew anything about a counterfeit bill at that point. And another thing that struck me was the same gentleman, after George Floyd was restrained, said, "Just get up," as if to say he can get up from the position that he was in. And George Floyd said, "I can't." And then that same gentleman didn't realize the situation that George Floyd was in until several other bystanders said, "That's kind of messed up what you guys are doing to him." Then that's when he kind of snapped out of it and realized what was happening to George Floyd. And that's the problem, is that we accept the treatment that we're given by this system. And I saw, I mean, what I heard was that man stuck in that Twilight Zone moment where we accept bad treatment by the system.
What does the intersection of race and class in this trial look like to you? What picture does it produce for you?
Well, what I see is basically George Floyd was lynched. This is a modern day lynching. There's no difference. As far as class, I don't think class has much to do with as much as race has to do with how police treat people. Like the previous caller said, he mentioned something about people being treated equally. I believe people judge a book by its cover more than they do by its content. And so race in particular, is the most major factor in how you're treated, in particular when it comes to law enforcement. Like I said, George Floyd was approached by the police in an extremely aggressive manner, and I understand why he was freaked out. They drew guns on him, for what? For a counterfeit bill that he had no idea why they were approaching him about. He was just afraid not to go back to jail, basically. And I believe that if he was any other race, he would not have been treated that way, whether you're poor or rich, because class tends to have to do with more your financial status and your background. And people, when they judge you, they don't know those things until they get to know you. But race is something that people judge right, as soon as they see you.
Do you see a class reference here? When I said class, I was hoping to hear you comment about Floyd. That covered race. It also covered class. He's automatically consigned to the lower class. The cops are white, and they do not perceive themselves as having a working class background. That's not the way they see themselves. So correct. I was wondering if that conjures up anything in your mind about race and class. You have two, essentially, these are working class people, all of them.
Correct.
But what distinguishes the notion of authority and superiority on the part of the cops as opposed to George Floyd and how they perceive him?
The police, I mean, that's a whole nother, like you said, it's a class. It's almost a class of its own, as we see that it's extremely difficult to indict find a police officer guilty of a crime unless it has to do with some sort of corruption or something like that, where it's like, but when it comes to like race, they are historically in the United States, they are the ones in charge of keeping us down. It's just a modern version of that. They're like an overseer, basically. That's what they are, a modern day overseer.
And what is the hesitancy in them, police officers? These particular police officers had no allegiance to their class. They had allegiance to their race, but they didn't understand the notion of class. They were working class people.
Here they are. The system. They work for the system, which is a white supremacist system.
God bless you.
And that's what I was saying, is that even we that are not part of the system engage in the system and accept the system and accept the treatment that we receive from the system. That's why I gave the example of the bystander saying, you can't win. Basically telling George Floyd, accept the treatment that you're getting. And then even told George Floyd, just get up, when in fact he couldn't get up,
And George Floyd said, that's the same man who broke down as he testified.
Oh, so that
yesterday.
Was the same one? Okay, because see, I heard it on the radio. Okay, see, because I'm pretty sure when he heard himself, because he probably couldn't remember what exact words of what he said. But when you listen to yourself on the tape, that's probably when it hit him like, wow, I can't believe I was saying what I was saying.
I interpreted it that when he said those words to George Floyd, you can't win, he was saying it partly as an observation from him about the inevitability.
He thought he was helping him out, but he was trying to save his life by giving him
that advice.
But in order to save your life, as a black man, in order to save your life with the police, you must, I guess, be dead. Because they can't kill you twice.
Well, it is how different people see the world based on the experiences that they've come through. And many people need to keep in mind that we haven't come through all the same experiences. There are people in this country who can tell you things that would make your skin crawl in terms of what for them was normal everyday life. How they survived and pulled through is a miracle. Thank you so much for contributing today. Brother David from Brooklyn, how are you doing?
Important point, and I want to approach it to add something in here. When you talk about race, you're talking about the phenotype of the person, the way the person looks. So
yes.
The phenotype of most African Americans looks one way. And most of the people who came from Europe, we call white, they have another phenotype. So if I think about what Elizabeth Wilkerson has written in her book, Caste, we have to understand a very important thing. There's this so-called, quote-unquote, white caste that includes ruling class people, professional class people, middle class people, and working class people. And that class includes all the people that have that European type phenotype. Okay, that's one thing. We have to understand also, it's not just simply race and class, but there's a caste under that called the black class. And that class includes, upper class black people, professional black people, working class and poor black people, just like the upper class or the top class, which is the white caste. So this is the caste that is underneath the white caste. So if someone in the white caste does something negative to someone in the lower caste, it doesn't come very hard if they can avoid doing anything to that person. If they do, they may do nothing or do very little in terms of transgressions against a person in the lower class, which is the black caste. However, if someone in the black caste commits some transgression against a person in the upper class, they come down very hard on that person. So in this particular case, you have someone in that upper caste, and even though a person in that caste may be lower than the top ruling class, he's in that caste. So all of the people who have that European phenotype are in a caste, even though all of them are not in the same class. And that's what we have here. we have either middle class or working class people working as police officers, and they're in that caste, and they support that caste, and doing something what I think is criminal to someone in a low caste. So that's the difference. So race and class are not just the same. You have caste and then phenotype, which people call race, and both those castes being that the white caste is the highest caste in this particular society, and the black caste is kept underneath. So you might be a multi-billionaire person in the black caste, you're still in the black caste. You're not in the top white ruling class. So, you know, that's what I think about it. And that's why I brought in the whole system of caste, you know. So for people who want to read about that, they can read Miss Wilkerson's book, which is an excellent book. I think it's very important that here's a person in the white caste has done something to a person in the black caste, though that is to his benefit right there. And the prosecutors in this case, some of them seem like they may be on his defense team, you see. So they're going to soften it up as much as they can. They can't obviously throw the case because they're, I'm sure they're aware of what reaction that would have nationally and around the world. But I think they're on his side. That's Mr. Chauvin. So I think that's important to everybody to recognize that we have a caste system here, just like Ms. Wilkerson has explained to us. And he is in one caste, and the victim of this crime is in a lower caste.
By being heard.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
All right. Yes, I don't know. I was cut off for a while.
I know. It's like, it's ridiculous what I've been going through as I was explaining.
Right. I think at this point, when I talk about Cass and what Ms. Wilkerson has taught us, in a place like, let's say, India, where you have people in the different castes that have the same phenotype. So you can't look at a person necessarily unless you know other things about them, like their name and the work they do, to know what caste they're in. But in this society, the way the caste system works is based on phenotype. And so you can just look at the person, see the phenotype, or what they call race here, and you decide what caste they're in. However, you might not know what class they're in. I mean, you might be a so-called black person with three PhDs and whatnot, and you don't know what the class they're in, like a professional class or not. You just see them. And I've experienced that type of thing quite often. They look at me and they say, oh, this black man, he must be a messenger boy, you see. So, or I get in the elevator and someone thinks I'm the elevator operator or something, you know. So the point is they look at you, and because your phenotype is what we call black people here, that puts you automatically in that caste, and it doesn't matter what class you are at all. You know, many of my relatives have, let's say, doctoral degrees. You know, they're physicians or PhDs and whatnot. And in the hospital, people think that they're the nurse's aide or something. So, you know, the caste is based on the way you look, the phenotype. So all the white people, no matter what class they're in, are in that top class. It's the white class, but the heads of the white class are the ruling class people, that 0.1% who run that class, but they allow all the rest of the phenotype white people to be in that class, even though they still maintain control of that caste completely, and you have the underclass of what we call black folks, and that's in a lesser caste system.
Okay. Thank you so much for your contribution today. Always worth listening to you and paying attention. Thank you so much for your call today. Jack from New York, you're on the air.
Latrice, I would like to join you, and I think I am unique to your show, but I do love to listen to you. I'm a Holocaust survivor. I was 7 years old. I'm 85 years now. And I asked that many of those questions then. And I am scared stiff what is going on today. What you're seeing now is a grand play with many actors, many parts of the play. They are going after the jackpot to put everybody. It's one time it was the Jews, it was the blacks today here. The black, and then you have now the they're killing the. I'm a little nervous, so forgive me for my speech.
You're doing just fine.
And then you have people, Chinese women, Orientals getting killed on the street. When you're dead, it doesn't make a difference who killed who. You're dead, okay? In the early years. This, what I heard afterwards, what I saw. saw is different than what I heard because I was only 7 years old. The Germans came over to the head of a certain community. He said, I want 500 people. I want 1,000 people. And he designated which ones are going to go. They took them to work. Sometimes they killed them right away. Whatever happened, everybody gave somebody else, figuring he's going to get saved. At the end, they took them all. Okay? That's just exactly what's going on here. Well, I am a basketball player. I love it. I am this. You might be black in color, but you're basically white. You're acting, the black guy is acting as a white man. And I'm not giving him an excuse. And I'm not giving an excuse for the white guy, you see? But we are taking on, we think we can escape. So now you have a case. Okay? Do you know? So what is the big, what are they really doing with the COVID? Is once they, by the way, everybody's Jewish now. As a Jew in Europe, you had a number in Auschwitz. You weren't Jack so-and-so. You had 1, 2, 3, 4. What do you have now? You have a digital number. You don't have a name. You're not black, you're not yellow. On their books, you are a number. And that number, they can take away your money from your number. They can do anything. And this is exactly what's going on. Once they get this law passed, they don't need to kill a black guy. They have everything. You have nothing. The white guys don't have nothing because for some reason or another, my interests are how much does people need to be happy with? How much money? How much money can you be? So I come up with this crazy idea. I call myself a living dinosaur who's becoming a bird. What I mean? The dinosaur was created. How it was created, I don't know. But it couldn't exist in a society when it could kill everybody. So somehow nature made it into a bird. It's flying now, can't do nothing. You understand? Something has to happen here. So, but the point that I'm trying to say is to share with your audience, there's no question what they're doing to the blacks. Because I went through, when I see people, the young guys with beards, would you believe it? It scares the hell out of me. Because if you had a beard in Europe, you were a Jew. They killed you. If you had gold teeth, they would pull your teeth out. At 7, I was hidden in a forest. Up to my, with 40 degrees. Why was I safe? I have no know. 40 Jews were there. Only 10 came out, 8 from our family. And one kid who was talking at 85 or 7, hidden under a pig. Okay, but this is just, I'm giving you a background, which I am afraid now. Now they're going on the bigger thing. They're not happy with the black suppression. They're not happy with the Jewish suppression. In whichever country, they're going globally. They don't have enough. But somehow in nature, nothing was ever settled by two people sitting down and having a conversation like you and I are having now. Something is going to bust, and that's what I'm afraid of, and that's why I'm very nervous, because Hitler didn't win, Mussolini didn't win. They all die, they all get destroyed, but they take a lot of people with them. So the only thing that I'm going to cut off to suggest that it's a sorry state, no question. How can you kill? How can you tell? Take, imagine people in trucks, in railroads. You take them, you bring them to Auschwitz. One finger goes here, one finger is dead, life and death. Then you take you, they tell you, take a shower. You take your child with you. You push him into a room, and you gas him. And then you have the other Jews or other ones to take those dead people and throw them into the ovens. And don't you think it was stinking around? People, I'm not saying they all were bad, because everybody wants to survive. So they don't smell nothing, they don't hear nothing. This is what's happening over here. Everybody thinks, oh, it's only the blacks. And the black guy says, well, he did it himself. He was a drug addict, he did this. It's only an excuse not to face the issue that there's a much bigger game. The game is everything they want. And technology, they have it. The digital revolution, they have it. And I hope I live long enough to see them fail. And you have a marvelous show. I really enjoy it. And it's very rare do I ever call up. But I did. The reason I did call is because I am a dinosaur. I live through it. I want you to know that when we came out of hiding out of Poland, they started killing you again. Why? Because if you told the Russian soldier that these people collaborated with the Germans, he didn't go to a court. He took his machine gun and just cut him off. Why? Because the American soldier was battle fatigued, but his family was safe. The Russian soldier was decimated, his family was decimated. So he took justice in his own hands. In order to protect himself, these guys said, we got to kill those Jews before they kill the Russians. So where the hell
are we? Today, I'm afraid we're out of time.
Anyway, I
am so glad that you called, and I'm so glad that you spent some time with us and shared the unique knowledge that you have. Tomorrow it's Free Your Mind Friday. Let's do that. Bye-bye.